Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
I was going to say, Tom, I needed to make this joke to you in person. You can give us the update about your cleaning projects, but you must divulge two personal details in exchange for every mention of the cleaning.
What cleaning projects have I talked about? I don't even know what we're talking about.
At the top of many episodes, you'll be like, well, I clean this and I clean that. And I do enjoy hearing it, but we need to season that with some more Tom, you know, some more salacious Tom bits.
I didn't know I did that. That's an interesting pattern. what does this say about me? We should do an entire podcast on that.
It says you're very tidy.
No.
Well, my wife and I have begun a decluttering process of the house. And basically the goal is if we sell 4 years from now, that's one of our goals. Mm-hmm. Let's not move stuff that we haven't, that we moved before, you know, that
there you
like,
go.
Just made in move. A box somewhere. So, I mean, like, here's an example. So we're both, you know, this is our second marriage for both of us. And she's this one cabinet, there's three hand mixers. Three. It's like, but there's only two of us. Why would there be three hand mixers? Yeah. So we decided we only needed one.
Well, that's an easy one, you know. That's pretty
good. So, well, we went through a lot of the magazines and DVDs and like all the stuff that just like, you know what? It's a grieving process, quite honestly, is what it is. And decided, let's use this word clutter. Now I said, you know, there's physical clutter and then there's spiritual clutter, you know? And I decided getting rid of some spiritual clutter at the same time.
Right. You know, I think that Marie Kondo is onto something. Do you ever watch her? Keep things that spark joy. She's big into that. But she does all these like, you know, decluttering kind of, that's her thing, you know, is like picking the stuff that you want to keep around and the stuff that you need to donate or whatever. But I mean, when things accumulate, that's a bear of a job. Yeah, for sure.
We decided to, it's a 234 phase project and we're in phase six.
You gotta start somewhere,
right? Phase seven might be tomorrow or a month from now. I don't know.
We've got a returning guest, Howard Mallets, from Seasons of Sobriety, and
what's his name? What's it? Yeah,
Howard Mallets.
Howard.
Hello.
From New Jersey.
How we doing, Howard?
I'm doing all right. Doing all right. It's good to be with everyone this afternoon.
Glad to have you back, man.
Thanks. The episode we had you on, I love that we titled it. Whenever I can land on a title that's got a little something to it, I'm always a little proud of our show. So Está Bien, you know, you landed on that in your recovery work. And that was one of my favorite episodes. So I was like, we got to circle back and get Howard back sometime.
While you're on that subject, Patrick, I want to tell you, you titled these things beautifully. It's like, and one of the things that somehow it fell to me when we were first doing our first podcast, Start Right Here. I was titling these and my titles sucked. And here's the technique of how I got you to take over for me. I just stopped doing it. and eventually stepped in and started doing it, but you do a beautiful job. I love your titles.
Thank you so much. You know, somebody told me at one point, and you'll notice in Start Right Here, that I would phrase the first few titles as questions, you know, a kind of like call to action. Somebody told me that was like a good hook to get audiences in. And then I abandoned that at a certain point, not because it's a bad idea or anything, but because, I mean, I don't know. I feel like you got to do what makes the most sense to yourself. And if you're a storyteller, however that story's being refracted, whether people dig it or not, you know, I mean, you've got to kind of do something that's true to your sensibility.
No, I think that I was talking to somebody the other day who was working on getting starting a new podcast and was talking about, you know, what the subject matter was and stuff. And they were just asking my opinion. And my opinion was that basically they were getting too specific before they even started. I said, you know, these are conversations and you want it to be organic. It's like, I mean, you're limiting yourself sort of like you do with, you have a rule about titles. It's like, you know, we're only going to talk about this or that. It's like, you know, our subject matter is, I mean, we're very fortunate that emotional sobriety is everywhere. So, you know, all we have to, we're doing talking about is application of emotional sobriety to whatever it is. But you can get too specific too soon.
Find more reasons to do it rather than less reasons to do it. You know, the first thing that's important is momentum and just getting something out there. So give us a brief check-in, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. It's I have nothing to say because you told me just a moment ago that I always check in with something I've cleaned, and I haven't cleaned anything this morning. So it's like, you know, I'm fine.
That's the problem. Yeah.
slacker. God's sake, Tom! Come on, clean something today.
I will eventually.
Can I ask briefly, Howard, how you been?
Working on my first year in the administration team at school, and it turned out to be a very, very good experience. You know, a lot of growth for me, and a lot of the, you know, echoing from, you know, my Mr. Doubt has stopped, because one of my little expressions is, you know, sometimes the opposite of fear isn't courage; it's experience. And, you know, once you get the experience and say, well, I can do this, like, oh, okay, I guess I'm not afraid to do it anymore. And there'll be nuances going forward, you know, in this second year. And so I completed that. I've had, you know, summer of, like I said earlier, the decluttering, which has been very cleansing, making some rooms, you walk into them and they just, and they're just so much softer, you know, without all the stuff in it. And just, it's like almost, I notice I feel safer in the room. You know, that it's just comfortable and nothing's attacking me saying, hey, you haven't done me yet. You know, you haven't taken care of this yet. And it's for both me and my wife. We were like, wow, this is nice. I'm glad we did this. And then just recently our son came to visit from Colorado, and it was great to see him. But what I noticed is I go through a cycle. When he leaves, there's some grieving for that. And, you know, because there's a change in the relationship. It's, you know, we're in a different season now where he's not here every day and I don't talk to him every day. And I know it's coming. I just don't know what it's going to look like. And so when he said he was leaving a day early to spend time with his brother and sister from his other, This is actually his bio dad. You know, they created another family and everything. And I was like, oh, but you're leaving Sunday. Oh, so, and it's like, oh, you know, one message could have been like, yeah, I'm not going to be with you on my last day. Or the other message is, I need to spend time with my brother and sister. That's all. I've spent enough time with you. We actually have an expression in our home. It's called day four. It's like when you're on a vacation or spending time with someone, it's like, oh my God, what's going on? Oh, it's day four. That's why, you know, and by day four, it's like, I think we spent all the time we need to, you know, cause it's very intense. It isn't like, cause he comes in town and he's here. He's
in my family. God, you said day four. I went, what the hell are you doing still there at day four? It's like our mission was our motto was get in, get the job done and get out. It's like,
yeah,
you have functional family than I did.
It used to be, you know, 48-hour rule. And then that was just if you met my mom, which you sort of did in that one session we did, you know, you'd see what. But if you met my son, you'd be like, oh, yeah, 4 days. Yeah, that's good.
We can do 4 days. Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
So and something interesting is my wife had her reaction after leaving. And she went into a lot of past stuff with this. Her ex-husband and all this stuff. And it was difficult for her. Cause it's like all these things that he and the stepmom said about her son and all this and wasn't true. And she just started to relive a lot of stuff. And so to help her with that, I said, I think we should go for a drive. So we went for a drive and had dinner and last night. And so here we are.
That's good.
So thank you, Patrick, for helping me get that out. Cause, it's the little things that kind of, you have to identify and uncover in order to recover, right?
Do you mean that in the sense of there's some part of your relationship you're recovering in your recovery from drugs and alcohol? Or
so I think I've recovered from that, the drugs and alcohol.
that subsequent recoveries.
Yeah, I mean that's like that's a matter of policy at this point that I don't do that. Yell at my boss is still in the policy. You know what I'm saying? So my level of recovery and bottom line is a little different now. Mm-hmm. What this kind of gets into is I finally understand what my mom's been going through all these years while I've been on the East Coast and she's in the Midwest, that, you know, why don't you come out and visit more? It would be a question. And it always made me feel like, well, so you're not here enough. You are not enough, all that stuff and everything. And I go, why does she do that? Right. I had to ask myself. And now that my son is, you know, thousands of miles away, I catch myself saying, it'd be nice to see you more. Nope. Let's not. Let's not put that on him. Let's get in a plane and go see him.
Nice.
So, yeah, that's kind of where my recovery is. Patrick is.
Yeah.
Later stage of life.
Two things that are coming up with that, Howard, is that you're saying two things, really. One is that it's important to always pause and not take what somebody else is doing personally.
Yes.
Yeah. Like you said, when you step back and say, oh, my God, he just wants to visit someone else. It's not that he's not wanting to visit me. He has an interest in this. It's not a lack of interest in me. And see, it's easy to take that personally. I mean, and we all do it. I mean, that's the big theme. If you pull out one theme from these podcasts and the Thursday night meeting, the fact that we make everything about us is really makes it an impossible way of life, right?
Yeah.
Because we're constantly now reacting and reacting to other people or our environment, you know, because it's not doing what it's supposed to do, right? That thing. And so we object and we get hung up in it. So that really stood out. The other thing that you just talked about, and I shared at a meeting last night in Flemington, that this self-alienation is so pervasive amongst us. And what it means is that self-alienation means when I look inside and try to figure out what's really going on with me and what I'm experiencing, how well am I able to find the words that most accurately reflect my experience at the time?
No.
Degree to which I can accurately, you know, find the words that accurately describe what my experience is the degree to which I am not alienated, but connected with self. Mm-hmm. When I don't know what those words are and have trouble finding them, that reflects the degree of alienation I experience. So, like, for a great example is asking a question. You know, would you like to, I'd like, you know, why don't, or saying something like, why don't you spend more time with me?
Yeah.
Is a high degree of self-alienation, because the person who's asking that is not in touch at all with that. It's really a statement that they are masking as a question.
Yeah.
They don't want to answer why. They're saying, I'd like to spend more time with you. Mm-hmm. But instead of being vulnerable and taking a risk and exposing that desire, which then may be rejected or, you know, that what we do is we play it safe. Why don't you spend more time with me? We put it over there, right? So the more connected I am, the more I let you see and experience what's really true for me. I am authentic, so to speak, right? The more connected, the more alienated I am, the more disingenuous I am.
Yeah, because I actually made sure to thank him for spending time with me.
Well, that's it. Because you enjoyed it. And the other thing is, and, you know, like you said, you could get on a plane. That's fine. That would be taking responsibility. You can also just own it and say, I'm realizing that I really miss you and I want to spend more time with you. And now, and I will take responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. You know, I will decide to visit you more this year. See, that would be a more personal statement to make. Right. So that you're owning just what you're experiencing. And we have trouble doing it. We have so much trouble for a lot of reasons, you know, this self-alienation. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about on Thursday as we've been going through my book about being asleep and dreaming we're awake, right? The Gurdjieff statement, right? We're all asleep, we're awake. That being asleep is what creates the self-alienation. When we fall asleep, and we're in a trance, we're just kind of, you know, we're automatons going through life, right? We're robotic. We're not paying attention to anything. We're not really. I mean, look, if we were really in touch with ourselves, do you think we would treat ourselves the way that we treat ourselves in terms of our addiction and stuff? Of course not. There has to be a disconnection. People call it a denial, but it's not. It's, you could say it's a denial. That's accurate in one degree, but it's not capturing the essence enough. It's an alienation.
Good.
It's better to think of it as an alienation, not a denial.
Well, sometimes my inventory at the end of the night is, you know, did I make a connection today? Or did I alienate? What did I do? And it's good. It's a good question.
That's a great question. When I'm not making that connection, I really feel it.
Did I connect to myself today? See, that's even another question. How well did I honor? Like I love Nathaniel Brandon has a whole book. I think you were reading this one, Tom, Honoring Thyself, right?
I love that. I love that book. Yeah.
I mean, it is such a powerful, powerful book because it really captures, you know, the essence of how alienated we really are from ourselves. And if I'm alienated, it's impossible to honor myself. 14 is about this. Now we're at the heart of the matter, the self-conscious level of organismic self-regulation. How about that?
There you go.
On the sensory perceptual level of consciousness that human beings share with animals, awareness is the controlling and regulating goal of an automatic integrative process. Automatic integrative means that the species takes in all the information from the environment, integrates it, as to respond appropriately to what it's experiencing by nature's programming. But on a higher level of consciousness, that's, by the way, that's supposed to be us human beings, higher level.
It's supposed to be.
I'm not so sure we all achieve much of that, but we have the potential for that higher level. This, he says, on the higher level of consciousness, on the conceptual plane, the exercise of mind is volitional. Meaning we have choice, right? Which means it is our responsibility. We activate and direct the process by setting the goal using our awareness, and that goal acts as the regulator and integrator of our mental activity, much of which happens, needless to say, at the subconscious level. For example, I woke up this morning, go to my desk, and I'm confronted with a vast array of papers, notes, research materials. I sit down, dimly aware that my mind is far from fully in focus. I look at my work and I think to myself, get going. In other words, I establish the goal of awareness by telling myself, in effect, grasp this, see where you left off, recreate your context, grasp the situation now, all right? Grasp what the situation now requires. That's so key. And proceed. I activate the appropriate mental state. See, that's what awareness does for us, is awareness puts me in touch with what is, right? That's that, you know, we talk about honest relationship with reality.
Right.
All right. What's the group? Oh, we were going to finish the check-in. Who else did not check in?
We need to hear from you, Alan.
Well, I think I just checked in, kind of.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it was beautiful. But are you doing okay?
You know, I've had a very good weekend. I had a really powerful share last night. It was exhausting. But I used that theme of alienation, self-alienation. As I look back in my life, you know, I can see now, you know, Bill called the reality has never been so starkly revealed. I can really see that, you know, now at this point in my recovery, how disconnected I really was from myself. And it's astonishing, and still can be. I'm not saying that those blind spots are all gone. You know, I still have them. So it's a powerful awareness. And I think one of the gifts of recovery today is I'm not beating myself up over that. Mm-hmm. I am kind of more in awe and curious about it.
Yeah.
Wow, look at this. This is interesting. Look at what's happened here. You know, what can I do today to try to, you know, increase my awareness, right? Wake up more today. Because even after 53 years, I know I'm asleep in some areas still. You know, maybe in a process of waking up in those areas, but there's still areas I'm asleep waking up from. And that's the joy of recovery, in my opinion, is this discovery thing that we're on. And that's part of what this podcast is continuing to discover new aspects and elements of emotional sobriety and have some fun with Tom, because Tom's always
Thank you. Well, I also want to say if any human being tells me, and I could be wrong about this, but I'd be willing to, but if any human being tells me that they're wide awake all the time and they don't doze, I don't trust them.
I would be frightened.
Yeah.
Frightened of that person.
Because one of the things, you know, that reminds me of the thing we were talking about, I think in the Thursday not long ago, I was talking about what I tell people is, you know, we have a disease of forgetting, and the solution to that is not a better memory, but to build our life, make our life full of reminders. You know, that's why I call it post-it note therapy, that we're all each other's post-it notes. And sometimes it's literally post-it notes. It's like I put a note up to remind myself to be aware of something that I need to be aware of. But the main thing is, it's like, and I know when to reach out for help. So all that stuff is humility. Yeah.
I have a post-it note that says, don't forget to remember.
Love it. Love it.
Hey, Alan, next time.
But you still do, right? But see, that's the imperfection. Yeah, you have a note that says this specifically. Do you always do it? Uh-uh. Yeah. That's great. Uh-huh.
So next time you're in Flemington, Al, let me know. I'll scoot on over and we'll go to a meeting together. That'd be fun.
I actually had a conscious thought to do that, and I got so distracted. I had so many balls in the air yesterday.
All right. Well, why don't we get started on this Grapevine article? And Howard, do you mind taking lead with the first paragraph? It's called When We Need Outside Help, from the 2024 March issue of A Grapevine.
I had an odd conversation about psychotherapy one time with some friends in the program as we were eating together after a meeting. The friend next to me had been seeing a psychologist, like I had, and we were talking about that. Then another friend at the table said to a third friend who was sitting there, "We don't need that if we just do what's in the book. Isn't that right?" I was able to point out, tactfully, I hope, that the book, the big book, is where it says to get mental health help when needed. So by going to therapy, I was in fact doing what's in the big book.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The truth is, though, that I have had that attitude against outside help myself. Though I've gone to therapy many times in my 20 years of sobriety, between therapy sessions, that voice will come in, "You wouldn't need this if you worked a better program." That's just another lie told by my disease, and it really goes back to my defective tendency to try to fix things myself, because my disease is rooted in self-centeredness. I have this old idea that I should need as little help as possible. Closely related to this is the old idea that I shouldn't look like I have any problems.
In double-digit sobriety, I tried to go without psychotherapy and also without psychiatric medication. I hope I never do that again. After maybe 10 or 11 months of that, I went from looking like I was doing okay to having a breakdown where I was actually physically unable to move. There was nothing in my big book about how to handle being catatonic in sobriety, so I needed to do what's suggested in the big book for people like me and get outside help. For several years, I had this idea that AA members with dual diagnoses were unusual. I thought that they were pure alcoholics in the big herd that I definitely had to try to blend into, and that there was another smaller group of poor souls who were dual diagnosed, who I would certainly pray for. Maybe I took Dr. Silkworth's classifications as the final word. I must either be only an alcoholic or the manic depressive type, which I couldn't identify with.
according to an article I found on the National Institute of Health website, about one third of alcoholics have some other sort of mood disorder. So if AA has 2 million members, it might make sense to guess that well over 500,000 could be dually diagnosed. For me, that's reassuring. It means I'm part of a very, very large group within our fellowship. So my needing therapy and other mental health help makes me a very normal alcoholic. It's not weird and it's not crazy. It's not a sign of untreated alcoholism. It's not any of the shaming lies that my committee in my head tells me. Is my secondary mental illness an outside issue? Is therapy simply outside help that I shouldn't discuss it in a meeting? I have been helped by our co-founder, Bill W., writing about his depression. He wrote about it in the grapevine in his article titled Emotional Sobriety, The Next Frontier. And in the pamphlet, Members Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous, which discusses getting this kind of help, I would suggest that anything impacting one third of AA members doesn't need to be treated as an outside issue.
According to Pass It On, the biography of Bill W., he had therapy sessions in sobriety with at least two mental health professionals. First mentioned in that book is Dr. Harry Tebow, who is also mentioned in the book AA Comes of Age, and who Bill said helped him with fear. The second one, Francis Weeks, talked with him about what today we might call codependency. He didn't shy away from discussing getting this kind of help with others outside of AA. I don't personally find that he saw them as unrelated to his sobriety. I guess she's mentioning here, I don't personally find that he saw going to psychotherapy and talking about a dual diagnosis as unrelated to sobriety. Mm-hmm. So understanding that I need and may always need professional help for my secondary mental illness, what can I say about that to other AA members? How do I share about this while staying well within the fifth tradition, keeping with AA's primary purpose? What part should it play in my story, in the message I try to carry? Somewhere along the way, I was introduced to the pamphlet AA for Alcoholics with Mental Health Illnesses and their sponsors. There I found the stories of 12 fellow AA members who share their stories, including their mental illnesses, with courage and clarity. They helped me feel more like I belong. What a gift that I hope to pass on. Wow, so much there.
Let me just say this first. This is because this goes to something I've done for years. When somebody talks about being dual diagnosed, my immediate response is to laugh and say, I scoff at dual diagnosis. I mean, if you only have two, you know, it's like, you know, hand me the DSM. I'll show you some diagnosing. It's like, you know, and it's that's a guide anyway. It's like we're all multiple diagnosed, or we may not be diagnosed, but we're both not diagnosable.
Yeah, I went to every article. Yeah, me too. I went to a retreat with my home group last Christmas, and the lead speaker who spoke on multiple days was this really cool, like masculine guy. He looked like he could be a character on Yellowstone. And he was careful to mention before he wrapped up that weekend that those of us that struggle, you know, with mental health issues, you know, we should absolutely seek, you know, outside help and therapy and medication if under the proper supervision. And I was so happy that he didn't leave that door closed for a lot of the people that were, you know, there fellowshipping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you sent this article, Patrick, and I read it, and it just, so many things came up from when I was early sobriety. Because one of the things that when you come in at 21, a lot of people have these little comments of like, well, I spilled more than you drank, and I, you know, all these things, you know. And what they did is they withheld their experience because they disapproved of the way I got here. And I felt it. And many of us young people felt it. And this one guy at a convention was talking about the third tradition, you know, about membership. And he says, you know, we always talk about how many people we save, and we forget to talk about how many people we kill. you know, with our careless and insensitive remarks about who can be here and who can't be here and what you can talk about, what you can't talk about. And, you know, be careful. Be wow. careful you don't alienate somebody. So I've held on to that for, you know, over 30 years.
That's beautiful and so important. And it's also a great example of how subtle it can be. Because, you know, it's like when you're talking about that, when, you know, how often as an old guy, forget about AA itself, but just how often as an old guy do I make comments about somebody's youth? Why is that? It's because I don't like being old, but it's like, I mean, but how careless might I be sometimes with things just in terms of being disrespectful. And when we're talking about being sure somebody is welcomed into AA, that's the most important thing we can do for anybody who comes into a meeting, period. Welcome them.
Yeah. I mean, I've pulled people aside after a meeting and they know I have, you know, double digit in decades. Mm-hmm. And when someone crosstalks about, you know, they talk about using Zoloft, right? Or something. And then mm-hmm. someone crosstalks and says, well, if you're using, yeah. And I pull them aside. I say, listen, I'm on Zoloft. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, and I give them a whole, you know, thing of how it happened and why I need that, to, you know, be balanced enough to be recovered. Do you know what I'm saying? And I need that. And you do? I said, yeah, yeah. I said, because we have a lot of doctors in AA. Unfortunately, many of them are not licensed. So please, you know, if you are questioning it, go to a licensed physician, not somebody with a cup of coffee after a meeting. Yes.
Good idea.
You guys can tell how I feel about this, right?
Yeah. Well, you're, it's, if you look close enough, I can figure it out. Yeah.
And Tom has honed those skills for years.
That's right. Yeah.
There is kind of a righteousness that goes on in the meetings. See, it's a weird thing that she was touching on. It's like, well, I'm better if I don't need help than you.
Right.
You're in an AA meeting. I mean, wait a minute. What, there's something. See, one of the things you can tell is a person's functioning can be determined by how congruent they are with what they say. The more congruent a person is, the healthier a person is.
Congruent, you mean with the parts of themselves?
Yeah.
Yeah, and with the reality. I mean, look, if I'm saying I'm critical of people going and getting help outside of AA and I'm going to AA to get help. What? You're faulting me for acknowledging, admitting I've got a problem that I'm getting help for, but yet you're in AA getting help for your alcoholism. See, it doesn't make sense when you look at it that way. It's incongruent.
Well, the other piece, Alan, was like, you know, you hear me talk, you know, 3 to 5 minutes in a meeting, and then you think you can speak into my life. So you don't have the whole story. You know, I gave you a piece and you're just voting into my life like you get a vote, you know, and that's the other piece. You say, like, we just got to be so careful of how unsafe we can make people feel in a meeting.
This might sound trite, but boundaries. I was at a meeting yesterday and the speaker said, never talk down to another alcoholic, which, you know, I don't know.
That's not trite.
No, that's but there's something about the way I heard it that just really keyed me into, like, I think, I don't know, there's a tendency sometimes, I don't know, just dealing with people, you know, where certain hierarchies emerge or assert themselves and that shouldn't be there. And like, and I think if we never talk down to another alcoholic, it helps us and it helps people on both sides of that equation, because it's one less form of separation, you know?
Yeah. Well, I want to speak to the ego, because a lot of this is about ego but not ego about my recovery, but ego about my addiction, my alcoholism, because I know this from, you know, I remember the old guys when I went in and who, you know, were just, what we would call bad alcoholics, as opposed to me, I guess. It's like, you know, the down and out, you know, homeless, you know, what is it? I think it's gamma alcoholic. If we look at Bill at the disease concept, but what I've noticed and confronted with myself after a while through the years, and I can feel it still in my mind, but I don't say it outside, is I tend to have after 38 years of sobriety, I have an alcoholic ego. You know, it's like, if I'm not drinking someplace, and I'm not very in place, many places where somebody's going to have a drink, but if they're ordering drinks, you can bet everybody's going to know I'm an alcoholic. Because I don't want people this is the truth about me. I have a part of me that doesn't want people to think I'm one of those people who doesn't drink. You know, it's like, no, I drank, you know, boy, did I drink. And it's like, there's some kind of weird ego pride in my alcoholism. And that can come across in meetings as well, because I remember feeling like, you know, some of these people were making the point that they were so bad, like you were talking about, I spilled more than you drank, is that they were so bad that I just wasn't bad enough to, I didn't have enough of a problem to be there. And I mean, how dangerous is that? And that's not even about recovery. That's about the ego that comes from my addiction.
Right. Yeah. I had one guy say to me, I don't even think you're a real alcoholic.
Oh, wow.
And about a year later, I was talking to him and I said, hey, you remember when you said that to me? He's like, yeah. Wow. And he said, I was hoping you didn't remember.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Now I have to admit, I have said to my wife that I didn't think she was a good alcoholic, because she's so much smarter and wiser and deeper than I am, because she decided herself, not without intervention, to go. She'd been in Al-Anon for years and years and years, and she decided herself to go to AA. You know, I have a couple of clients like that. That basically, you know, I call them volunteers. You know, they, you know, it's like you didn't have to fight them to get in there. But I don't mean it literally. I just tell the, you know, she didn't. You know, you're not a good alcoholic because you went in voluntarily. It's like,
how was that received?
She hadn't really liked me that much.
But she married a man.
It's all kind of the same.
Well, I like saying that, you know, what makes me an alcoholic isn't the way I behaved when I drank. It's how I behave when I'm not drinking.
That's the truth.
I mean,
it's both. Yeah.
But it's more evident. You know, there was a piece in that story too about, you know, having this shield of like, I don't need this stuff and everything. And you know, I came across many years ago, this another acronym for fear, which is you know, frantic or fierce effort to appear recovered.
Never heard that one.
Yeah. And me either. I heard it a few years ago. I was in Israel actually. And this lady, mm-hmm. I was like, that's beautiful. Right. Cause you know, the alcoholic who still suffers could be someone with 23 years, almost getting a divorce. Their kids don't talk to them and they don't know why. They're sleepwalking essentially, mm-hmm. but they're suffering just as much as the person in their first week or more.
Yep. Yes.
You know, because it's worse. Cause like you said, Tom, they have this, you know, well, I got all this time. I can't talk about how awful I feel.
Yeah.
And then this is their prisoner of their own kind of ego.
Right.
It's tough.
Well, Alan, I was hoping you'd like the article because it's got some shout outs for some of your favorite people in there.
Well, it does. I mean, look, he's talking about the therapy with Harry Thiebaud. I didn't know about this Weeks person. I'll have to look into that. I wasn't aware that he had worked with this person. But look, it's this idea that somehow it's an outside issue. It just is so misinformed. Because even Bill talks about the causes and conditions. Our drinking was but a symptom. Well, what is he talking about? That we all got other issues that are related to this. And, you know, I think emotional sobriety helps boil all of this stuff down to a basic flaw. Because regardless of what other psychiatric symptoms that you're showing, and that's how you classify someone with a diagnosis, it is totally a symptom-driven diagnostic system now. They moved away from a theoretical system. Now it's like, if you have four of these symptoms and you've had them for this amount of time, then you have this problem. Mm-hmm. So it's a total checklist kind of a thing, because they wanted the diagnostic system to be a theoretical. Mm-hmm. But if we move away from that and we even look at what's underneath that, right, then you start getting down to this basic flaw of our absolute dependence. Mm-hmm. And the havoc that that wrecks in our life. I mean, so, you know, it's, you know, like we talked about, like we've been talking about on Thursday nights, you know, while some person might, that's a perfectionist, might think that that's, you know, an outside issue, it's really not. You know, it's right. all part of the same thing that we're all struggling with, is trying to understand our patterns. What Bill said is, you know, he tried to understand what was the formula that helped him understand what created or triggered his depression. And he got it. He says, is that when I make demands on other people and they don't cooperate, and then when he tries to force them to do it and they still don't, then he gets depressed. He feels defeated.
Right.
That becomes the issue.
Well, that's and I sometimes in simplistic terms, I say, somebody asked me about what emotional sobriety is, we can define it in lots of different ways. I just say, you know, it's the big A, you know, it's the big addiction beneath all others. It's like, so, and it may take many forms, but like what you just said, it's like I'm in what Bill's letter says, which is if when you find yourself in distress, look, and you will find unrealistic expectations. It's like I always point out, he doesn't say look to see if there are unrealistic expectations. he, you know, and I'm all for being flexible and being open minded, but this is the perfect place to not be, to say no. There are, you know, because I'll point that out to somebody sometimes, and they'll look and they'll say, no, I don't have any unrealistic expectations, but yeah, they're still in distress because so-and-so is acting a certain way. It takes a while to get a hold of that, but it's still addiction, in my opinion. Addiction becomes, or has become for me through the years, as more, maybe I should say as much, but maybe more a model of thinking about the human condition than it is actually a clinical diagnosis. You know, it's like, because you can just plug like what we know about Buddhism in there and attachment. We become too attached to things, and we mistakenly believe we have to have that to be all right.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's in Bill's writing or not about, you know, having an unnaturally emotional attachment to an outcome or to an expectation. Yeah. Because a natural expectation is, if I go out to start my car, it'll start. I take care of it. I do all the things I'm supposed to do. And if it doesn't, I'll be like, oh, well, that's weird. You know, but I won't come apart. Like, how can this happen? Well, it's a car. It's got moving parts and some of them break. So, and then, you know, there's one that my car will always start, you know, like, well, that's a little, you know, or is there something wrong with my car? Because I'm so emotionally, you know, naturally emotionally attached to, like, everything's got to get done, that I have my list. And it's like, well, I guess it won't. Right.
That's good. If I just, as contrast, if I went out and tried to start my car and it didn't start, my response would be, let me see if I can just access it. It would be, what? How dare you? After all I've done for you, you're not going to start this morning. You know, that would be, yeah. And I see now that I probably should look at that.
I feed you, I bathe you, right?
Oh, I don't bathe mine.
Well, I think you know.
There's your problem.
Thank you, Howard.
Yeah. And sometimes it's like, why is it my responsibility to walk around with a box of diapers for you people? You know? Come on.
Thanks for showing up, guys, and being with each other for this.
Yeah, and good choice of an article, Patrick. Yeah. Thank you.
I think it's such a myth in AA, you know, that says an outside issue. It's like, no, it's well inside.
Tend your life, tend your myth, cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.